Hi, and welcome back to our friendly Whispering Gallery listeners. We're so glad to have you with us today. The days are already growing longer, which cheers me more than you know. I've always liked Vincent's art. I think Emily as well. One of the first pieces of art I purchased was a print of his irises. See this on Instagram. The painting has lovely hues of green, purples, blue, creamy white, and is a bouquet of cut iris in a white pitcher. There could be 20 blooms of flowers there, or more. I get lost in his brushstrokes, so I'm not sure how many there are, but it is lovely. I found the pitcher on the Met, and so let me read you what they say about it. Quote, Irises, 1890. In May 1890, just before he checked himself out of the asylum at St. Remy, Van Gogh painted four exuberant bouquets of spring flowers, the only still lifes of any ambition he had undertaken during his year-long stay, two of irises, two of roses, in contrasting color schemes and formats. In the museum's irises, he sought a harmonious and soft effect, placing the violet flowers against a pink background, which have since faded, owing to his use of fugitive red pigments. Another work from this series, Roses, 1993.400.5, hangs in the adjacent gallery. Both were owned by the artist's mother until her death in 1907. Unquote. I read the book Lust for Life by Irving Stone, and I remember it being so good. I should probably reread it. A definite recommended read. In fact, maybe we should start a book club. Let us know what you think, either DM us on Instagram, join the Facebook group, or email us at whisperingcontact@gmail.com. Join us as we step back into a different time, to Vincent van Gogh, the mid to late 1800s with the swirling colors of his oil paint, the mysteries about what really happened with his ear, his death, and what was going on with his health. The swirling of the green fairy absinthe as water and sugar filter into a glass that might hold more than just a strong spirit, but other things like hallucinations and seizures. The more we dig into the story, the more mysteries we find. Let's get started taking a look at things just beyond the shadows of time gone by.
When I was looking into it, it's kind of unknown exactly what his mental illness was, although there's like a lot of speculation about it. So it sounds like it was basically bipolar, but it was called manic depression, I think, back then, before the term was changed to bipolar. So the quote that I have is from ncbi.nlm.nih.gov.
National Center for Biotechnology Information. I was just wondering where it was.
So the quote is, plagued by psychiatric illness throughout his life, Van Gogh committed suicide in 1890, which I know we'll talk about later, but evidence suggests that he had manic depression and bipolar disorder, a chronic mental illness that affects many creative people. Which, I mean, this seems a little weird, but although treatment within lithium carbonate is now available, the drug also dampens creative abilities. Many people believe the artists overcome suffering with their creative acts, but suffering may also overwhelm the artist. Had lithium carbonate therapy been available, Van Gogh might have defeated his manic depression, avoided his tragic fate, and grown further as an artist. This is a quote from Van Gogh. "If I could have worked without this accursed disease, what things I might have done." And he wrote that in one of his last letters.
I'm sure, you know, you and me and the other artists, our friends that are listening, we get into that place and you disconnect from the monkey mind or whatever you want to call it that they talk about in meditation.
For sure. It's like, it's just a whole different state. Like, I don't know how to get into that without drawing or painting. Like, it's like a whole different mindset.
I think those last couple of months, wasn't he super productive, or that last year?
Uh-huh.
That was one of his most busy years, putting out paintings.
Yeah. The bipolar theory makes sense to me, because with like mania, if he was in a state of like mania, it could have maybe justified his productivity in that time period, if he was really like feeling it and really, you know, that's, he was just living and breathing art, you know. I feel like, while I know a little bit about bipolar, I also feel like, kind of like this quote really generalized bipolar, and like many creative people are, you know.
I think that's a huge generalization.
Yeah, it's, so I kind of feel like this fits from an outside perspective, like looking in on like maybe he did have bipolar, but also it's kind of like, I feel like it's almost too easy, you know, like he could have just been really depressed, you know.
Well, and depending on how many of those stories were true of things happening during a manic attack or a mania when he was in that state.
Mm-hmm.
In the reading about Vincent Theo, in that book, Vincent and Theo, the Van Gogh brothers, they talked about, sorry, I keep wanting to say Theo, because the lady had listened to the book on tape. So Theo said that there were like two Vincents, and I feel so much, you know, like, I know how to pronounce that, and you know, no, I don't. So who knows? I hope the reader had it right. Theo said there were like two Vincents, and he was super stormy with his moods. And I think I had told you that Theo was wiped out after they'd been roommates for a year.
I feel like with our experience, that's definitely true. As far as for our family member who had bipolar, it's a very similar feeling.
You know, the beauty and the charm and the loving nature when they're in their normal space.
Mm-hmm.
And during an attack or a whatever you want to call it, the change, just like Van Gogh, the change in that person,
yeah,
is pretty huge. It's not just a,
like, it's a whole other level.
She had a rough time of it, and she was, mm-hmm, on medicine
and the whole 9 yards to try to handle it.
Yeah, because that article, it's like, if they just had this lithium.
The reason why I liked that quote, or the why I took that,
uh-huh,
out of all of the research that I kind of looked into with his mental health, was just that quote from him. You know, like, it's, I feel like almost all artists can relate to that. Like, if you didn't have procrastination, or if you didn't have depression or anxiety, or like, you know, didn't have,
yeah,
this, you know, accursed disease, you know, which I feel like maybe I'm just fitting it to myself, but also like, just, you know, like what things you could do, you know, like if, mm-hmm, if you just were able to, you know, create and like get out there. But that's kind of all I had about mental illness, just that it was super intense and kind of carried on through basically his whole life. And I think it kind of shows through like how he went through, like, I think we all go through it, like obsessive phases, but I feel like that really happened with Van Gogh, as far as like his like fervor for like religion at first, and then it kind of transferred into painting, and he was like obsessed, you know.
Mm-hmm. And like his palette too, I'd read that it changed one time down the road, and I don't know why that happened, but the first grouping of colors, the yellows and the greens, and it was a palette it sounds like he stuck to pretty closely. Whole different topic of what paint was available back then, you know, as far as, or how, if you bought it in a tube or if you mixed your own, you know, depending. I think he got it in tubes. mm-hmm. from what I understand.
That's what I was thinking, too. I think I have a quote about paint tubes in here.
Okay. To draw his photograph the other day, mm-hmm. and it didn't turn out great. There wasn't a lot of light and dark, you know, or chiaroscuro or whatever that's called to define, and he was completely washed out. And but he looks like he's maybe 17 to 19 years old. What I was going to say was I think he was born with a lesion on his brain which caused seizures. So there's that going on. Then there's the illness of the manic depression or bipolar. And then, so he goes into those, they called them attacks, but I think now we would, I don't know, the way I think of it would be a spiral, wouldn't you? Like when they crash and they end up in that manic depressed state. But yeah. Maybe it's harder core, harder core than crash. I don't know.
I think, you know, to be just so vague, our family member, I think, had described it as a spiral several times, you know, that she just felt like she was going down and couldn't pull back out, you know.
That would be horrific. That would be really tough to see it coming mm-hmm. and know you were going to be stuck for a while. She also worked for awareness of bipolar for mm-hmm. people to understand. I had another thing that I think ties into this, and I know you have controlled substances you want to talk about later. Maybe they weren't controlled back then, but we heard about that he might, I think you looked up turpentine and I looked up paint. I read a couple places, they would say he would nibble on paint chips. And I'm like, seriously?
Yeah.
From what I've read of him, he wouldn't take the time to sit there and nibble. The man was very intense and not, I don't know. Maybe it was a nervous habit. Who knows? But when we talked about that painting he scraped off and the, you know, how he felt guilty and was telling Theo about it. And it's, I don't think he'd be like drying pieces up or saving them around. There's not a lot of chips laying around once we're done with our paintings, at least in my house.
There's one quote that I found, which this is from the Van Gogh Museum. Mm-hmm. So it says, Van Gogh never ate yellow paint, quite the contrary. But then in the next sentence, they contradict themselves because it says during his time at the institution in Saint-Remy, he wrote in a letter to Theo, it appears that I pick up filthy things and eat them, although my memories of these bad moments are vague. The medical notes of Dr. Piron, Vincent's physician, reveal that Vincent wanted to poison himself by eating paint and drinking turpentine. That's mm-hmm. probably why he wasn't allowed into his studio while he was suffering from his attacks.
Yes.
But I thought that was interesting because I could totally see, you know, if he's just like wandering around and like it'd be like chewing on your nails, you know, like mm-hmm. if he like sees a paint flick or whatever and is just, you know, like nibbling, but.
Yeah, I getcha.
Like, nervous.
If he doesn't remember and there is stuff laying around. I mean, I know like at art studios at school and stuff, there were, you know, more and he produced a lot. So maybe there was more around. So I do know that they said when he was in his manic state that he would, a couple times he ate paint to poison himself. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that was the same deal with the turpentine, but yeah. I'm not sure. So he, from what I understand, had mainly a diet of coffee, bread, and absinthe. So I don't know what else he ate.
Live the dream.
Yeah, live the dream, dude. Yeah, so I'm not sure, because I think protein was more expensive, mm-hmm. and so I know he was super conscious of Theo's dollar, you know, that he was, his money that he was sending.
Chose.
you want to talk about what you know about absinthe?
Sure. I have several quotes from a Washington Post article titled Why Van Gogh Ate Paint, which this is covering absinthe, so I'm not sure why. absinthe is a strong emerald green liquor flavored with wormwood and other herbs. Another painter, Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec, may have introduced Van Gogh to the bitter drink. This gave him new evidence that an affinity for terpenes, a common class of compounds in aromatic plants, may have caused the painter's fits and hallucinations and possibly led to a pica or depraved appetite for non-food items like paint. Arnold said wormwood contains thujone, a terpenine, which can cause stomach problems, similar to those Van Gogh complained of, and nervous system problems like mood swings, convulsions, permanent brain damage, and even death. In the last 18 years of his life, when Van Gogh experienced at least 4 fits of hallucinations resembling those described by absinthe drinkers, he was exposing himself to increasing amounts of thujone. Thujone can have especially strong effects in concert with nicotine, and Van Gogh acknowledged he smoked too much.
And thujone was in his cigarettes then?
No, it's in the absinthe.
Okay.
So absinthe contains wormwood, which is like an herb, and then wormwood contains thujone. I think that's how you say it. It's T-H-U-J-O-N-E.
Okay.
But yeah. So it says, in one letter to his brother, Van Gogh said he fought insomnia with a very, very strong dose of camphor in my pillow and mattress. Arnold said camphor has the same effects as thujone on the body.
What did he use the camphor for again? Sorry.
Insomnia.
Insomnia.
He put it on his pillow and his mattress. Oh, a goodness. Very strong dose. So I'm not sure what that means, but it doesn't sound great. And then just before he was committed to an asylum, Van Gogh had to be restrained from drinking about a quart of essence of turpentine from the bottle. Others report that Van Gogh ate paint containing turpentine, which contains pinene? P-I-N-E-N-E?
P-I-N-E-N-E. Pinene? P-I-N-E-N-E. Pinene. Yeah, sorry, don't know.
Pinene? I don't know. But yeah, so it just sounds like absinthe was not the greatest thing in the world as far as like drinks of choice go.
Absinthe contains 54 to 74% alcohol. Here's a reading from Wikipedia. It's an anise-flavored spirit derived from botanicals, including the flowers and leaves of Artemisia absinthium, or grand woodworm, together with green anise, sweet fennel, and other medicinal and culinary herbs. Absinthe traditionally has a natural green color, but may also be colorless. It is commonly referred to in historical literature as le fée verte, or the green fairy. It is sometimes mistakenly referred to as a liqueur, but is not traditionally bottled with added sugar, and is therefore clarified as a spirit. Absinthe is traditionally bottled at a high level of alcohol by volume, but is normally diluted with water before being consumed. By 1915, absinthe had been banned in the United States and in much of Europe, including France, the Netherlands, Belgium, Switzerland, Austria, and Hungary, yet it has not been demonstrated to be any more dangerous than ordinary spirits. Recent studies have shown that absinthe's psychoactive properties have been exaggerated, apart from that of the alcohol.
It sounded like it was popular with artists. And
yeah.
he was kind of like in touch with his artist friends that was, you know, cool. But then it's like, oh, well, you guys maybe should find another drink, especially if people are having hallucinations.
I think maybe that's why they drank it, like almost like how it's like, expand your mind, dude. You know, like.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Like,
I don't know. I could be totally up at night, but I would suspect that's why it was so popular.
I would not have thought that, but you're right. Yeah, that makes sense. Like, oh, geez. Yeah.
I'm like, if you just want to be drunk, like, why not wine or beer or like literally anything else?
Didn't they say that, was it absinthe that caused the halos around things?
Just a sec. I have...
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I put it in a separate section. So his use of yellow is... So this is a quote from ncbi.nlm.nih.gov, the same one as before. Mm-hmm. So this says, first, he was fond of absinthe, the popular liquor containing thujone. Excessive consumption of this liquor may cause the consumer to see all objects with a yellow hue. Investigations conducted in 1991, however, showed that a person must drink 182 liters of absinthe to produce this visual effect, so we can likely discount this theory. A second and more likely explanation involves over-medication with digitalis. People receiving large and repeated doses of this drug often see the world with a yellow-green tint. They complain of seeing yellow spots surrounded by coronas, much like those in the Starry Night. The artist's physician, Paul Ferdinand Gachet, may have treated Van Gogh's epilepsy with digitalis, a common practice at that time. In one of Van Gogh's three portraits of Gachet, the physician holds a stem of digitalis purpurea, the purple foxglove from which the drug is extracted. It sounds like absinthe can definitely do it, but you'll be, like, dead, like, by the time it's producing, like, yellow. Yeah, I don't know. The foxglove theory sounds good, though, and it sounds like it produces the same effect without, you know, 182 liters of absinthe. So.
Wow, yeah, it sounds like a lot of the things that were in his life or that he was exposed to are medications, as well as the absinthe or what, the turpentine. Or it sounds like he was exposed to a lot of external things that were just battling it out in his system.
Kind of sounds like, you know, depression and anxiety when that starts to kick in is like, what, like 10 to 14-ish? I mean, generally speaking.
Could be, yeah. You know?
It seems like that's when your brain starts to really kind of develop more and, like, I don't know. Totally off base here, but it seems like more mental illness comes into play in, like, the tween years, you know?
Yeah, I would think some stuff could. I know that's a hard, difficult time with mm-hmm. friends and people that are being jerks or not, or, you know, I remember it as a difficult time, and I remember the stuff you went through, and also, you know, like, hormones and different things affecting moods and things, so I don't know. I haven't researched the ages, but just from, I was going to say with Vincent, he moved around a lot and was, I think, like a lot of young people. I mean, I moved around a bit as I was trying to figure myself out. And what was I going to do? Was I hitting college? Was I going to work? What was I going to do? Who was I going to be? And the thing I didn't understand was that, you know, I was still becoming. I'm still becoming. You're still, you know, we all still kind of continue to do our thing. And Vincent was hard at work and super intense on his theological studies and moving around. And it's like, I don't know if he was moving because he was pushed to, or, you know, like, not pushed to by anybody, but himself, that unable to settle down. Mm-hmm. And needing to go somewhere else. And so I don't know, that in hearing the way Theo talked about how wiped out he was and sick he was by the time Vincent was going to move out, and he didn't want to make Vincent feel bad, so he wasn't going to kick him out. So it's like, but he was getting sick because Vincent was just draining him.
Uh-huh.
And I can see how difficult that would have been for Theo, because he loved his brother and didn't want to hurt him. And yet, meanwhile, his own life essence is being sucked away through these hard things.
I think the only thing I have left is the suicide, which I think maybe I could read my, like, quote that I have, and then you could go into the, like, alternate theory.
Okay, sure.
Okay. So the quote that I have is from Wikipedia. It's from The Death of Vincent van Gogh. So The Death of Vincent van Gogh, the Dutch post-impressionist painter, occurred in the early morning of the 29th of July in 1890 in his room at the Oberg Ravo in the village of Auvers-sur-Oise. I hope that's right. They're in France. Van Gogh was shot in the stomach, either by himself or by others, and died 2 days later.
I watched that movie, Loving Vincent, and they explained how one of the guys that he was hanging out with had, I think he'd borrowed somebody's gun, and so or taken it, and he had the gun. And this was one of Vincent's friends that he hung out with, but the guy was kind of rambunctious, and like he'd bring girls around stuff, and they'd go down to the river, and Vincent didn't seem to have time for that kind of stuff. He'd be drawing all the time. So the theory was, not just in the movie or the book about the Van Gogh brothers, it's possible that somebody else shot Vincent in the stomach. In the movie, they explain that the angle going up towards his stomach, he'd have had to fire the gun with his foot or a toe or something. Could be done, I'm sure, but it would be very difficult. The thought was that some kids were hassling him out in the fields, and that maybe one of them had shot him, and he was covering up for the kids, which mm-hmm. is similar to the idea of him covering up for Gauguin. So, but Gauguin wrote to Theo after Vincent's death a really nice letter. So it's like, I don't know that there was like a lot of guilt making him do that, or just a friend expressing, you know. Because I would think after a few years, or however long it was, that he would feel regret of the loss of that friendship and that artist, you know, that's...
Absolutely, yeah.
I don't think there was much they could do for him where the entry was during that time period. And I think that was it on his death, was just that other theory. Did I read out how many letters he wrote?
I don't think so.
I found a Wikipedia article. And he wrote 22 letters to Emile Bernard, talking about technique, color, and theories, so art. There are 844 letters surviving. 663 were written to Theo.
Cute!
9 to Theo and Joe. And letters to Vincent from Theo, only 39 survive. So I don't know if they made the moves with him or not, or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like Theo was hanging on to him. He did love his brother. You know, when he heard Vincent was dying, he went to him. You know, he took care of him. They talk about the milk pact that they made. Or yeah. I don't know if it's called a pact, but a promise.
Yeah, I think you touched on it the last episode, but you could totally do it again.
Okay, that they were out for a walk. I don't know if it was by a windmill or where they stopped, but it was off to the side of where they were walking, and they stopped and had fresh milk. And while they're having their conversation there, they promise to always have each other's back. And so we should do that, Em. I have your back.
Okay. I have your back.
Awesome. Okay. It's a promise over my Sprite or my 7-Up.
I don't have anything, but like, cheers, man.
Virtual cheers, man. Okay. Everybody should have someone that has their back. Mm-hmm. Or several someones.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear about Theo a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely.
Vincent worked for a little while in an art gallery, and then I think that was, what, maybe 2 or 3 years, I think. And then Theo worked in a gallery. He was Vincent's younger brother, and he was always an art dealer, always sold art. He created, it sounded like a mezzanine level or a floor between floors, so I guess it's a mezzanine. They didn't call it that, where he was able to put an impressionist show out, or I don't know if it was a show, but it was where he displayed them for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very much in support of Impressionism and very connected. And when Vincent, towards the time when Vincent was had died, Theo was setting up in a new apartment, and before they moved in, he had set up a show of all of Vincent's works in that other apartment that was larger, because uh-huh. he'd gotten married. He'd fallen for this lady, and he professed that he loved her, and she was like, dude, I don't know you, and we'll just see, you know, let's know, you know. So after a while, she was like liking another guy, and then that didn't work out, and then she was like, well, maybe I could give this guy a chance and we could just see. And then it was like, boom, they fell for each other. Uh-huh. And I think she showed up and they talked, and then it was just like, you know, just kind of rolled from there, and they got married, and Theo was older, and I mean, not an old man or anything, but older by then. And I think this was maybe in the last years of his life too, the last few. And they had a baby, and Vincent created that painting of the almond branches with the bright blue sky, and it's just lovely for the baby they had. And so,
aww,
super cute. And they named the baby Vincent Willem van Gogh, and Vincent was his godfather, so he named him after Vincent. And so, yeah, it was just sweet all around. But it's like, oh, just love, and you know, nice happiness despite all of this rough stuff that's going on, you know.
Yeah.
And Theo is sending Vincent money, and you know, Vincent wanted to go to the south of France to paint, and he had this idyllic view of all the artists coming to paint together. That's, you know, and then that just kind of crashed hard and fast. And so I think it was, wasn't it October when Gauguin moved in, and then he left in December?
I was like,
okay, that didn't work.
Yeah, totally out of there.
Yeah. And so when the show opened in Theo's apartment, sorry to jump back to that, Theo was getting sick, and he was put into an institution as well, or I think it was an institution, not just a hospital, where he was suffering from syphilis, and it was causing mental breakdown, and like Joe couldn't go see him. And it is Johanna van Gogh was her name.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they wouldn't let her in, and but I don't think he knew who she was at the, you know, toward the end there. And so it was just so sad to hear how he went. I think it was like months after Vincent went and he died from that. It just was heartbreaking to hear. And he had just started his life with his new wife and baby, and you know, they were just getting going and so in love. And you know, it just, he didn't pass the disease on to Johanna sorry, Joe. So that was good. It just was rough that the two brothers went out in similar, I mean, you know, whether it was suicide or somebody shot him, but both of them struggled so hard, you know, with mental stuff. And I believe Johanna, well, obviously kept the letters and things, and I think they still helped the show, because our, and letters came in from artists and people all over who had known Vincent. And I would highly recommend reading the Van Gogh brothers. It's Theo and Vincent, and I'll put this up on our Instagram as one of our links for this show coming up. His intensity about theology and religion. I was just like, oh, you know, this is a lot.
Yeah.
And it's still going. And we're doing it some more. And okay, really? And God bless him, you know. But he was, people always say that about people that are like, what the?
Yeah.
But yeah, he was very passionate, and so, and good on him, man, for that passion and following his bliss. And I mean, and that's what he did. He followed his bliss with his painting.
Mm-hmm.
So, and somebody had suggested to him, are you sure you're putting your passion to the right thing with religion? And I don't know. So then he ended up painting and really painting up a storm. So anything else you want to talk about with him?
I had two recommendations. There's a great interview with David Hockney about Van Gogh on YouTube. If you just type in David Hockney Van Gogh interview, it should pull up. I really enjoyed hearing another, like a professional, you know, working artist talk about Van Gogh and just that different perspective of like a more modern artist,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking about Van Gogh. I really liked it. Also, Music Nerd, Vincent by Don McLean. I'm sure everybody older than me has heard this song many, many times. I had not, but it's a great song. It's by the same guy who did American Pie. And it's just really, really good. And yeah, it's just basically about Vincent. So highly recommend those too.
I've got some research about what was called Vincent van Gogh's ghost paintings. So I was surprised and intrigued to learn that there was a ghost painting as I began research about Vincent Van Gogh. I wondered if he had painted over a painting like I'd heard about, with there being a painting over the Mona Lisa. It took me a minute to process the story and come to understand a bit more about what had happened and why. Simply put, Vincent had painted Jesus in Gethsemane and scraped it off, not once, but twice, in a 3-month period. He called it a Garden of Olives in a letter to Theo. There was Christ, an angel, trees, and hills. In quoting from letter number 637, he said, "I tell myself it's wrong to do figures of that importance without a model." In letter 685, he had done it again. Quoting him, he said, "For the second time, I've scraped off a study of Christ with the angel in the Garden of Olives." So I know he was very aware of the expense of paint and supplies that Theo sent to him. He was feeling pretty strongly about it, I think, and if he was willing to scrape off the paint and not let it dry or show anyone.
Well, and sometimes too, I mean, I think you and I have both felt that when it's just like, get rid of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, if there's just no saving it or taking it where you want it to go.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be interesting to hear how Theo responded to this. And I know this would have been very important to Vincent, given his strong feelings about religion. And so that's interesting, you know, that one was such a difficult one for him to work on. At one point, Vincent was thinking about working in pencil since it was so much less expensive than the paints. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just being mindful of his brother paying for everything.
Yeah, like supporting him.
Uh-huh. I read about the ghost painting in Van Gogh's Ghost Paintings by Cliff Edwards, Art and Spirit in Gethsemane.
This is wrapping up our episodes on Vincent Van Gogh. I hope you discovered some new things as we did, as we followed his mysteries, which are still unsolved, but it's really interesting to know about. If we allow mental illness to be a stigma and to steer how we treat each other, we need to have more understanding for each other. You guys are great. Thanks for being curious with us. Look for us on Instagram, and please comment or leave notes. We love to talk to you. And thanks to Jeannie and Rob for your comments. We'll be talking to you again soon with our next story of a very strange painting of a cat. Thank you. Many thanks to Precious Nocturne for her ukulele cover of La Vie en Rose that was found on archive.org. And we're using it as fair use, and it's under the public domain mark.